One of the challenges of looking at Easter texts is, what do you do with doubting Thomas? You can look at doubting Thomas and say, oh, I'd never be like that. That's one option. You can look at doubting Thomas and say, well, Thomas was a skeptical kind of guy, and we can understand his skepticism. We're skeptical people. There are many different ways of looking at doubting Thomas, making him the hero of the story or the villain or however you want to look at it. But it was pointed out to me this year that John chapter 20 doesn't really focus on doubting Thomas to the exclusion of other people, but the idea of faithfulness and belief is shot through John chapter 20. And that when you look at John chapter 20 as a big unit, from the beginning of John chapter 20 to the end, you'll see that there are all different types of faith listed there and demonstrated there. And that John chapter 20 is a way for us to place ourselves on the timeline of our faith and faithfulness. We can locate ourselves somewhere in there. And as it is with John, one of the most difficult things about the Gospel of John is that John tells stories very well. And he tells them on a very literal level. And then he tells them on a more spiritual level, on a deeper level. And you have to dig sometimes to find out what John is actually talking about. And there are constantly new surprises popping up in the Gospel of John. And that's exactly what we have here in this story of the empty tomb and the appearance to the disciples. On Easter Sunday, the very first person who believes, the very first person who accepts the resurrection of Jesus needs absolutely no proof at all. It's this person in John's gospel who is called the beloved disciple. We don't know his name. We think it may have been John himself, but he was being humble. And John himself races with Peter to the tomb. And when John, this beloved disciple, and Peter get to the tomb, they look inside, and it says that this beloved disciple saw and believed. Period. Saw and believed. The beloved disciple had the kind of faith that just needed no proof. He just knew at that moment that this was what had been built up for them. This was what had been hoped for them. This is what Jesus was training them for. And the beloved disciple was that kind of a person. That's the kind of faith and faithfulness that he had. He needed no proof. For some people, that's how faith works. For some people, that is indeed the way faith works. People who have a great talent, people who are excellent ball players, who don't need to work very hard and don't have to practice very hard, great athletes who are just born with it. Those are folks who don't need a lot of proof. Somebody who can open up the hood of the car and they can look in there and figure out what goes where and what's not going right and just mechanically minded and have always been mechanically minded from the time they were little kids moving around the trucks in the sandbox. That's the kind of faith that the beloved disciple had. It's just a natural sort of innate kind of thing. You don't need proof. It just sort of happens. Sometimes we're good at that. Sometimes we're not. Sometimes that's our faith and sometimes it isn't. I don't know if you've ever read the book A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle. It's a fascinating book. It's a Christian story, but it's also a fantasy story. It's very sort of like Harry Potter, I guess, or Wizard of Oz, if you haven't read the book. Alice in Wonderland kind of themes. It's a very good book. But Madeleine L'Engle had written this book, and it has Christian themes all through it, and it had all this fantasy element all through it, and science fiction element. And it was rejected by publisher after publisher after publisher after publisher, 30-some odd. And they couldn't figure out whether this book belonged as a children's book or as an adult book. They couldn't figure out who the audience was for the book. That's why the publishers kept rejecting it. And the neat thing that I liked about Madeleine L'Engle was she wouldn't answer them. She wouldn't answer them. And finally, when she found a publisher in 1962, I believe, to publish the book, they had to put it on the bookshelves as both children's books and adult books because she still refused to answer them, whether it was a kid's book or an adult book. And the reason of this was she believed that people often undersold kids. She believed that people often gave kids books that were kind of, you know, easy reading kinds of things, and she thought that kids could do better and have better imaginations if sort of adults backed off a little bit and gave them some maybe difficult things, and they might blossom with them. And so she didn't want to pigeonhole anybody who wanted to pick up this book. She thought anybody could get something out of it if they were able to read the vocabulary in it, if they were old enough to know the vocabulary. Well, the interesting thing about it was she won the highest medal of writing for children's books for this novel, and it sold massive quantities. And the reason it sold massive quantities was because it was in two sections of the bookstore. It was in the adult section and in the kids section. And it sold huge amounts that nobody ever expected a first-time author with her first contract to sell. But she had that much faith that the story of the gospel would work, no matter who you were, whether you were 8 or 9 years old, I think that would be about the age that's right here, or if you were 35 or 45 or 65. And she refused to be pigeonholed. She refused to say that the gospel was only a kid's story or only a grown-up story. She said anybody can understand it. That's the kind of belief and faith that the beloved disciple had. There was no evidence for it other than the empty tomb, but he didn't need proof. He just had faith. But that's not where the story ends. The story moves from John and Peter, the beloved disciple John and Peter, moving out and going away to proclaim what they had seen, that the tomb was empty. And then we have this scene that we heard about with the kids, about Mary Magdalene coming upon the tomb. And Mary Magdalene believes, not when she first sees Jesus, she actually mistakes him for the gardener at first. She asks, "Where have they taken the body of my Lord? Grave robbers have been here. Someone's taken him away." She actually believes once Jesus says her name. When Jesus says Mary, she starts to believe. She believes in response to one word from our Lord. And sometimes our faith is like that. We need a word that will encourage us, that will move us from one place to another, that will bring out things that we didn't know we had in ourselves. I was talking about this story to my brother-in-law yesterday, and this story from John's Gospel, and he said, "You know, that's really interesting because I now have a doctorate in higher education," he said. He said, "When I was younger, I didn't know that's what I wanted to do until one of my friends pulled me aside and said, 'You are really good at this higher education kinds of stuff. You need to go on and move into that field.'" And now he said, I've reached a pretty high point in that field, and now he works at a college in Chicago, and he has spent his adult life in higher education, which was not something that he was looking at going into, but something that somebody else said, "This is what you are really good at." That's the kind of faith that Mary has, the kind of faith that you encounter something. You're going on one road and you go in a different direction. You have a conversion experience. It's a little bit different than the beloved disciple who just believes. Takes a minute longer, but something, you've run into something and it's changed your life. Then what do we do with Thomas? I've preached many sermons where I've said, "Don't be like Thomas. I know I've done this, but I don't want to preach any more like that," because when I look at the whole gamut of John 20, it's just a different kind of faith. Thomas is the kind of person, it seems to me, that needs some sort of physicality. He says, "I want to touch the nail prints in Jesus' hand and the spear mark in his side before I'll believe." Thomas is the kind of person that needs somebody to show him how things work. And you know people like this. You know people that can read math problems, but until somebody shows them how to do the math problem, they will never figure it out. You know people who can read how to make a craft, but it doesn't make any sense to them. But if somebody shows them side by side, you will figure it out. The classic example is my grandmother's chocolate chip cookies. her recipe. She took it to her grave. The recipe, we have the card, and she always made them really, really delicious. They were crunchy on the outside and gooey on the inside. It was perfect. My dad has tried to replicate that recipe. He has tried to figure out what happened, how she did that. What is on the card is not what she did. There is something that she did along the way, and nobody ever thought to stand side by side with her in the kitchen and replicate that. There was something, and it's lost. That happens. That's the kind of faith that Thomas had. He needed somebody to work with him in the kitchen. He didn't want to read the recipe. He wants somebody side by side with him. Well, here's what a quarter cup of flour looks like. Here's how these things work. And that's how he gets it. That's how he gets it. Each one of these examples shows us different points in our faith. Sometimes we get it right away. We hear it and we understand it. Other times somebody needs to come over and tap us on the shoulder and say, hey, pay attention here. Other times we need somebody to show us what faith is really about. John chapter 20 shows us all of these demonstrations. Shows us all the ways to do this. And then at point... Then, there's one other group of people that I left out. I realized when I did my my outline here, there's one whole other group that I left out, and that's the disciples. I was looking at the beloved disciple, and then I was looking at Mary, and then I was looking at Thomas, but there's also another group that believes, and that group is the disciples, when Jesus shows up and Thomas isn't there. The disciples believe because they're in a group, and they are working together. They're the church. That's another kind of faith. We meet together so that we can encourage each other's faith, that it's not something you do alone. It can't be done alone. There's a management guru whose name is Meg Wheatley. And she wrote and has told the story about going to Senegal. She went to Senegal and she was surprised to find out that suicide is unheard of in Senegalese culture. It's unheard of. They never commit suicide. There's no culture on earth like it. There are suicide is a problem in every other country in the world. It's a very tragic and difficult problem. And she asked them, how come it doesn't happen here? And the Senegalese said to her that we're all in this together and that we are never alone. If you lose your job, someone will find you a job. If you lose your home, you will not be homeless. Someone will take care of you. They don't even think of themselves as individuals, but they rather think of themselves as part of a community group. And Meg Wheatley draws from that. She says, you know what? That's really how all of us interact in society. We just don't know it. We really are in a group together. We really are all tied together. We can't do everything alone. I didn't build this sanctuary, nor did you. Somebody else built it for us. I am standing on the shoulders of giants preaching here. I wasn't the first preacher, and I hope I won't be the last preacher that has stood in this pulpit. There are many, many people in the chain who got us to this point. We didn't get here alone. Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for microfinancing. You remember microfinancing? He talked about how you give small loans to people in particular countries and you get them started on a business, and that's a way to get people out of poverty. He made an interesting statement one time. He said that we have the capability to get everyone in the world out of poverty. We have the smarts. Human ingenuity has gotten to that point. We just do not have the capability to do it as people. We have the smarts. We have the technological know-how. We could do it, but we don't see ourselves as connected with each other enough. There are too many variables in the equation, if you will. People being selfish, people not paying attention, people who don't have the will or the desire, people who are part of governments that are corrupt. That's what the disciples are all about we are connected, whether we know it or not. And our faith is connected. Sometimes you need somebody to say, you know what? I've been praying for you, even if you don't have enough faith to pray for yourself. I've been praying for you to get through this crisis, even if you've been struggling. I have hope in you, even if you don't see hope in your own life. So the question this morning and the challenge this morning is, where is your faithfulness? Where is it? Where are you right now? Not where were you 10 years ago, because it could be different. It could change from day to day. Are you the beloved disciple who you immediately accept it and say, yes, that's the kind of faith that I have? Or are you like Mary Magdalene, who needs a word from somebody, who needs a message from somebody? Or are you like Thomas? You need somebody to show you. You need somebody to walk beside you. Whichever of those examples you are, whichever of those people that you are right now, you may not be that next week. You may not be that 3 months from now. But we're all in this together as disciples of Jesus Christ. And he has appeared before us and said to us, "Peace be with you, for he has been raised." Amen.